We'll look behind the fourth wall today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Fourth Wall Films is making a name for itself, and Kelly Rundle will tell us how they do it on Scribble. That's an old, established term, fourth wall.
Yes, it is.
Breaking the fourth wall in theater and so on. But you've been making news yourself. Raising a Barn, I think, has got a lot of attention.
The Barn Raisers?
The Barn Raisers, whatever it is.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, in my old age, my memory is no good.
That's right.
How long have you been making documentary? You and your wife together, right?
Yes, we worked together on the films, and we've been doing that since the mid-90s is when we first started shooting.
In Moline?
We were actually based in Los Angeles at that time, but we were doing a story of documentary, our first documentary on the Villisca axe murder story. So that was in southwest Iowa.
Mm-hmm. What prompted the – well, first of all, you were in L.A. because that's the center of a lot of activity.
I had it in my head that I wanted to work in the conventional movie industry. And so we moved from the Kansas City area where we went to school to Los Angeles. And I worked there for 7 years for Columbia Pictures. And about 2 or 3 years into that gig, which was a great way to learn about the business side of things, we started talking about producing something independently. And that's when we began working on the film Villisca, Living with a Mystery.
Mm-hmm. What prompted the move back to the Midwest?
That was in 2007, and I was working full-time on our production company. We had successfully released the Villisca film, and we were distributing it. I was out of our spare bedroom, and it spent a little over a year in theaters in the Midwest. But we wanted to continue making stories based in the Midwest.
And why the Midwest?
Well, that's where we're both from.
Okay.
And, you know, people on the East Coast, I think a lot of the stories on the East Coast and the West Coast kind of get recycled over and over again. And all the great stories we have here maybe sometimes aren't told.
Mm-hmm. So we're on mined territory?
Well, I think so in some ways. And I think some of the best stories are here.
Well, you have come up with some very good ones, I'll say that.
You know, years ago, I've told the story before, I, many years ago, ran across a group of people we'd call hippies in the park with the aroma of marijuana in the air. I went over and told them, look, I don't care what you're up to, but the police come through here, so I just want to let you know in case you might want to relocate. And we got to talking. I said, why aren't you on the East Coast? He says, we've been on best Coast, man, but people there don't know who they are. Says, we like it here in the Midwest.
So how did you end up in Moline?
That was just based on where we found a house.
Okay.
We looked in several communities in this region, and something came up in Moline, and I grew up in East Moline, graduated from United Township High School, so I was happy to come back.
So you're in the Midwest, you're making documentaries. How do you even get an idea for a documentary?
Yeah, I sometimes feel like the topics choose us. You know, we did select that first one, and then the second one, which was called Lost Nation, the Iowaway, the story of the people for whom the state of Iowa is named, that one was suggested to us by someone who saw the first film when we screened it in Red Oak, Iowa. And others have come to us in that way with ideas. And So sometimes it just feels like these things are seeking us out.
But now you've been commissioned to do at least the one you did on the Dakota.
Yeah, the museum film that we did for South Dakota's new estate park. But again, there was a connection. That was a story. Specifically, that story was something we'd known about for a decade because of our work on the Iowa project.
Okay.
So all of the other producers, and there were many all across the country who were bidding for that job, would have been gleaning that story from the internet, and there isn't a lot of good information there.
Yeah, you have to get into documents, don't you, to really understand?
Well, and we did that in particular on that Villisca story because it was there were some good primary documents to look at, including a coroner's inquest and then thousands of pages of a grand jury testimony that we were able to get access to.
What when you get an idea or a commission, what follows? The script?
No.
No. Well, then what is the process?
Well, it's a little different with a documentary than it is with something like, well, we did a docudrama, shot a docudrama 2 or 3 years ago. That was fully scripted. But with the documentary ideas, we start off, because we have to do fundraising and grants and things like that, we start off with maybe 2 or 3 sentences that describe the film that we want to make, that we think we're going to make. And then when the film is completed, if we go back to that, you know, it's the film we made. But we never know what people will say when we sit down to interview them. So there are lots of little twists and turns along the journey.
But so where do you get the – you said people invest in your films? I mean, how do you get the money to make a film?
Yeah, no, people do not invest.
Oh.
Films are very poor investments.
Okay.
But our historical documentaries are partially funded by Humanities Council grants, and depending on where we're working. So I think we've probably had grants from maybe 7 different Midwestern Humanities Councils over the year.
Okay.
Over the years. More than a dozen grants.
So it's a grant you apply for.
We have to apply for it, and like so many things, it's competitive. And so we get almost every grant we apply for.
Mm-hmm. But then the process – if you decide to pick a topic, then is it at that point that you begin to assemble the sources of information, the people you will interview?
Yes. And we try to often there's an expert or someone who's kind of a leader with that particular topic, whatever it might be. So, for example, with the Villisca documentary, we met and worked with Dr. Ed Epperle, who is someone who at this point has researched that one topic in Iowa history for more than 50 years.
Yeah, well, so that would be the guy.
Yeah, so he already had some of his own, a lot of his own research material. And then we did our own research, you know, to supplement and to focus on those areas that we were interested in.
How do you select people to interview, and how do you get them to consent?
The people are often people with an expertise. Maybe they've done some writing on the subject. Maybe they've done their own research and are preparing to write and haven't written yet. Sometimes, well, for example, with the barn raisers, we had support from some of the state barn organizations interested in barn preservation. So they would often recommend someone to us. Sometimes someone you interview recommends someone. So kind of like other things, one thing leads to another.
Well, you collect all of this information and interviews, but how do you stitch it together? Surely a script has to come in at some point.
It depends on the film. And I don't know the numbers for every documentary, but I know for the film Country School, One Room, One Nation, that we interviewed over 50 people. And that seems a little daunting when you start trying to boil it down. But along the way, you realize as you're doing these interviews that maybe 2 or 3 of those people are going to become your primary storytellers. And we don't often use narration, so our interviewees are the storytellers. Then other people that you interviewed either come in to play as for supplementary kinds of information, or maybe they're not in, most of them aren't in the film at all. Mm-hmm. But they all helped you understand the story a little bit better. And so even though they're not in the film, you know, their message reached you and it becomes part of the film.
Well, you talk about stories as having a beginning and a middle and an end.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find the shape for a documentary?
I suppose it's similar to telling any story. And, you know, we have a three-act structure in mind as we're working on films. But we don't adhere to it strictly in terms of a formula at this point. But it is the way we would tell a story, the way others do too. The difference would be, for example, with the Villisca film, the story was so complex that we did get a small grant from Humanities Iowa. That was our first grant from them, just to do a script. And we did put together a formal script before we began the editing process. And we ended up using a narrator on that project because of the complexity of the story. However, with the second film, Lost Nation, the Iowa, I remember we put kind of scenes or elements of the film on index cards and then kind of arranged them on a drafting table. And then as we were editing, we kept kind of referring back to that, and then we would move the cards around, or we would, you know, remove cards from the sequence. So that was a more informal process. Our last film, documentary, The Barn Raisers, even less formal in the sense that we kind of wrote it as we were editing. We didn't have anything on paper, but a kind of an outline and some notes. We do review the interviews and make notes about comments that we think we might use. And it's a lot of stuff to bring together to tell a story.
I imagine you have a lot of material, a lot of footage to boil down into a specific time slot.
We do.
How is that editing done?
It's painful sometimes.
I'm glad to hear that because I used to go through that in early days of television.
Right. No, it is painful because often you have something that's just a marvelous story and somehow it just doesn't fit into the way you end up telling the story. But for the Country School film, I know we had over 80 hours of material that we gathered over a three-year period. So lots of really interesting stuff falls on the cutting room floor.
And how long was the final product? How
many? 72 minutes.
Out of 80 hours.
Yes.
Wow.
And we visited over 100 country schools in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Kansas. So we really dive in as deeply as we can over
that
a two- or three-year period.
Time-consuming business.
It is. I often envy people who just work with a canvas and a brush or with a word processor, you know, in their home.
I have a question that I actually did write down. Where does a documentary fit in between history and fiction?
Well, it's nonfiction. So, you know, we're telling a true story.
What's the difference between nonfiction and history? No, I mean.
Well, I would say they're the same. We're dealing with a factual topic, and for us, we're really concerned about being accurate. So, for example, after the first few screenings of our Villisca documentary, we realized that in one case there was it was the narrator who was saying something as simple as First Street instead of First Avenue, and you know we went to the trouble of fixing that. So it's our documentaries, our historical documentaries, are nonfiction. They are a creative way of telling us a story from history.
But this must be an interesting way to live, to go from one project to another. Do you have, while you're working on one project, do you have another one in process and a third one you're thinking about? How do you work all that together?
That's exactly what we do. And unfortunately, it all has to do with funding, because if funding came in all at when you needed it, then we wouldn't need to have multiple horses. But yeah, we have to ride on the horse that's running. And we have at least three projects underway right now. So that's why we do it that way. It makes you a little crazy sometimes jumping from topic to topic, even within the course of the same day, often.
You know, I often interview a movie critic, Linda Cook.
Yes.
And documentaries are her favorites. She prefers a good documentary to a good film and a good movie. Mm-hmm. And she laments the fact that people don't pay that much attention to them. Where is your audience for this?
Well, I think we do. All of our films are featured theatrically, sometimes in conventional movie theaters, sometimes in special screenings, colleges, universities, other kinds of special events. They are broadcast on Midwestern PBS stations, and we do release our films nationally on DVD, and we're streaming them online now. So, but they are sort of niche topics. And mm-hmm. so we have to discover ways of finding the audience for those films. And it can be a challenge at times. But I think Linda's right. When we go to film festivals, the most interesting films are always the documentaries. I mean, almost always. But the festivals tend to emphasize, you know, the mm-hmm. fictional films, the narrative films.
Well, there are three film companies in the Quad Cities that make documentary films. Yours is the most famous, but then there's Heritage mm-hmm. Documentaries and then D Films over at Augustana College. Mm-hmm. And they make, you know, thrillers too, but they do make documentaries for various people. So documentaries still are, you know, when I grew up and went to the movies, before every movie there was a little documentary. Quite often it was a travelogue, but not always. It was a little insight into this or that, or the very kind of thing that Kelly's talking about. And they don't do that anymore. But, you know, I would have felt cheated if I hadn't gotten the cartoon and the documentary and then the Western that I came to watch.
Oh, yeah. Fitzgerald's voice travelogues.
We get emails from people who will say, I remember there was one related to the Villisca film, and it was from a man, and he said, I did not want to go see this movie. My wife dragged me to it. I loved it, you know. But that's often the challenge. People expect something that's going to be dry. It's not going to be interesting, maybe not entertaining. And that dry, not entertaining film is hopefully not what we're making.
Well, you know, life is more interesting than fiction because—
That is the attraction. It's true and it's real. And that's why people enjoy a good documentary.
What does Fourth Wall Films suggest symbolically other than just a really good title? Does it suggest you're, you know, not touching it? I mean, because not all theater is fourth wall theater either, right?
Well, Tammy in college was involved with theater work. And I can remember when we first talked about a name for our company, we were on Interstate 35, either headed toward Kansas City or toward the Quad Cities, I forget which. And we thought of that as a name for the company. So in the world of theater, you know that the fourth wall is the missing wall.
Right.
Yeah.
And if we think about that in a movie theater, well, we're watching the film on the fourth
right.
wall. So it's just the idea of an interface between the performance and the audience.
How many films are you working on now?
I think three.
Three seems to be the magic number, doesn't it?
I don't know.
This one is getting close. That one's in the middle, and this one's in the hatching
and, you know,
stage.
And sometimes it takes longer to give birth than at other times. And just a few years ago, we completed a film about Iowa actress Jean Seberg. And that had so much third-party material in it, film clips and publicity stills and other things, that we've had to go through a long and complicated legal process to get all of those things cleared regarding fair use or licensed. Mm-hmm. So that we expect to complete this year, finally.
You know, that is a process, though, that trying to get clearance.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago when I was doing such things for television, it was pretty informal. And you were able to just proceed, you know, on the assumption maybe that was kind of a news story. But then you'd make a documentary out of it. But when you need material that one person has, you've got to get a license.
We do, and we're careful about that as we should be.
Mm-hmm. Are you free to make these films any length you feel appropriate, or because they're going to be on public television, do they have to fit within any time constraints?
There are some time constraints, although the film Country School that I mentioned is 72 minutes, and when that's been broadcast, it's been broadcast at full length. PBS 1 hour is 56 minutes and 40 seconds. The half hour is 26:40, I think.
Yeah.
So we have kind of settled in for our larger films at that 56-minute mark. And then when we release a DVD, we're able to put additional features and things.
Years ago, I did a documentary on the Rock Island Arsenal. I got the film completed and timed it, 45 minutes. I had to get it down to 28.
Yes.
And I sat up all night long.
Yeah, it's
snipping,
tough.
Clipping, gluing. It was just murder. I hated to do that.
No, it is hard. And you often end up, even when you've edited it to your length, you often end up throwing away something that you really, really liked. But you just have to admit that it doesn't fit.
Do you come across most of your ideas sort of by happenstance, or do you deliberately go looking for?
It seems like we've just stumbled into things, except for that first film. We did develop, meaning we did some initial research on three different topics and settled on the axe murder story.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a crowd pleaser.
It really was. And, you know, we had a little trouble finding funding for it because people thought it would automatically be something exploitive. But, goodness, you don't have to, add any embellishment to an axe murder of eight people, an entire family. So,
yeah, well, anyway, you are off and running and at least moving at a good clip. So you have three films in process now, huh?
We do, and the one that's kind of different from what we've done before would be the docudrama, Sons and Daughters of Thunder. And on the writing side, we adapted or wrote a screenplay that was adapted from a play by an Iowa playwright. So that was a little bit of a process to try to take something designed for the stage and rework it for the screen, while adding our own touches to it along the way.
So did you have to use actors and actresses for that? Or
we did. There were a couple of times where we had some of the larger scenes where we had 50 or 60 people on the set at one time, including the extras.
And where do you find them?
We worked with a casting director here locally, Kim Kurtenbach. And so most of them were local. We had one or two from Chicago and a gentleman also from Los Angeles.
Well, it sounds to me as if it's an all-encompassing profession and really keeps you occupied. I must say, from doing all of it yourself, from the business end to the artistic end, that's a chore.
I sometimes compare it to farming because, you know, we like my grandparents, you know, we never left the farm. We never leave the farm.
Right? Kelly Rundle in Fourth Wall Films is our guest today, and we look forward to the next one. Sons and Daughters of Thunder will be the next.
In the fall, yes.
In the fall, okay. And with that, we will take a break and then shift over to the book bag. And from films, we delve into the book bag. And what do we find there, Roel?
Well, a small book, and I don't even know how I came across this. I think somebody slipped it to me, unbeknownst. But it's a book that's very small, looks like a gift book that you kind you might give for graduation or a birthday or something. Inspirational book, but it's called Dear Madam President, and it's by Jennifer Palmieri, who was with the Clinton campaign and with the Clintons as their press secretary for a long time. This book purports to be, it's in the form of a letter with several chapters, to whoever will be the first woman president in the United States.
Mm.
Dear Madam President is the title. And so, first of all, it's an insider view of the Clinton campaign that Hillary just lost, and what went wrong, and how the Clintons responded to things in ways maybe that they shouldn't have. It's an analysis of a still male-dominated culture in our culture, and how you ought to advise about how you ought to live in that. And then an advice to this future president and to all women in our culture on how to survive and thrive. Her message is don't try to be as good as a man, try to be as good as a woman, right? I mean, don't try to be other than yourself. Women do things differently, she concludes, but just as good as a man could do. At any rate, the best part for me was the inside view of the campaign as the campaign, Clinton's campaign, grew increasingly problematic toward the end and more desperate and things that they did wrong and shouldn't have done wrong. And they kind of knew they were in real trouble a couple of weeks before the actual end of the election. Anyway, it's a fun little book to read, and it's also full of very good advice, particularly, I think, if you're a young woman just graduating from high school and need something to inspire you.
It probably will be a long time before we say, Madam President, don't you think? It's hard to predict in this day and age. Things flip so fast. Social mores and customs seem to change almost overnight. But this was a really interesting loss.
Yeah, and it probably is a loss that probably is going to keep losing for a while. I don't know.
Yeah, it's very...
Yeah, I've been wrong for 2 years now, saying, well, this is it, you know, and I've been wrong, so...
Well, you know, the things that are animating elections, we like to think that elections are about ideas, and they aren't. They're about feelings. And people who know how to manipulate feelings are the ones who will come out on top. On election day, or when a person is making that choice, it's how you feel about the two candidates. And the whole drive in elections is to make you dislike one and like or at least accept the other.
Right.
And that's...
It's always been that way.
It's always been that way, but it's become a science of late. And so, you know, there's a fair amount of manipulation involved, but...
Well, you go back and look, you know, you go through the Lincoln Museum in Springfield and see the things said about Lincoln and, whoa.
Yeah, oh, yeah. But he didn't have the internet working against it.
Yeah, but anyway.
So, the book and the author, once again.
Dear Madam President, and it's Jennifer Palmieri.
Jennifer Palmieri. You say it's a small book?
It's a little gift-sized book, and it's only maybe 150 pages. Great, great for a gift for a young woman.
Okay, well, we'll make that note. And with that, we will head to the exit here. And thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Scribble. Roll Tweet, and I'll be back next week, and we hope you will too. We'll see you then.